this morning. We're going to start in John chapter 4. Now, all the scriptures that I'm going to post are going to be from the English Standard Version. And if you know anything about me when I preach, I tend to go a little bit quick. So you probably won't be able to flip there in time. So I will give everybody a copy of the PowerPoint if they want it. Just let me know and I'll email it to you. So this morning, we're going to start in John chapter 4. And verse 23 says, "But the hour is coming and now is here, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship Him. And God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth." So what that should tell us is that Satan doesn't have to get us to stop worshiping God. He doesn't have to get us to worship Him. All He really has to do is get us to worship in a way that isn't acceptable to God. So what does He mean when He says that we have to worship in spirit? We've talked a lot about worshiping in truth. We've talked a lot about authority. But what does that mean that we worship in spirit? Now, last time I preached, I talked about the word spirit and how it can have like four different meanings. It could be breath, it could be wind, it could be spirit, or it could be your mind. I think we can make a really good argument that spirit here is saying that we're focused on spiritual things. That we're not like those in John chapter 6 who are all about physical food. And I think there's a really good argument for that. But I think really here his point is that we serve God with our mind. We serve God with all of our heart. If it's going to be acceptable to Him, it can't just be the right actions where we are worshiping in truth. But it also has to be the right kind of heart, the right kind of mindset, where we're really focused on the things that we're doing. We sang some great songs this morning, didn't we? If we all meant that, if we all meant every word that we were singing, God's a pretty happy fellow right now, because that's what He wanted from us. He wanted us to be singing out from our heart, saying the right things, and saying it from the right place with the right motivation. Okay. One thing this verse tells us is that a true worshiper to God is something that He values. And how do we know that? That word seeking. You don't seek things that you don't care about, do you? Anybody ever gone out seeking after something they really, really don't want, really don't care about? Anybody? Just raise your hands. Anybody? Nobody? No, because you seek things that you see value in, right? And so God is seeking people who are going to be these true worshipers. I want you to think about something this morning. If you knew that someone was going to steal money from you today, what would you do? Well, we would do everything we could to stop it, wouldn't we? Think about all the things that we do in order to keep the things that we own safe from burglars. We might have an alarm system on our house. Maybe it has video surveillance. Maybe you're a dog person, so you've got guard dogs. Maybe you're rich and you've got security guards. Maybe you're just redneck, and like myself, and you prefer to use a weapon. And so you have a gun, you have a taser, you have a baseball bat, a knife, you know, whatever. You have something in place to protect the things that you care about. And why do we do that? It's because we put a value on those things, don't we? Well, we know, look, if somebody steals my car, well, I'm out $5,000, $15,000, $20,000. If you spend more than that, you should be ashamed of yourselves, by the way. If somebody steals my TV, I know at least $200 to replace a TV. My laptop goes missing, $200 to $400 minimum. I'm not going to find it any cheaper than that. Okay, look, I got to protect that because I'm going to be out whatever that value is. So how do we value our worship to God? And giving God true worship, how valuable is that to us? See, it's important that we value it the way we should, okay? Because someone wants to take it from us. But first of all, let's talk about this. This is something really basic, but it's something I think we need to always be reminding ourselves about. Does God deserve our worship? Why should we worship God? You know, why should I be giving everything that I've got into this worship? Why should I be focused on the words I'm saying? Why should I get up every morning on Sunday and be enthusiastic to get here. Why? First reason is simple. He's our Creator. He is a God who speaks and things exist. I was giving my sister a ride to my granny's so she could stay the night there. And so we had the audio Bible going. We read through Genesis 1. And when we got done, we were both just like, wow. You know, how can you not be impressed? One chapter. One chapter basically covers the entirety of, hey, look, this is everything that exists. And he just said it and it was. If that doesn't impress you, well, I don't know how you would be impressed. And so the other aspect of this is not only is he our Creator, he's so great that we should respect him and his power, but every good thing comes from him. Isn't that what James says? In James 1:17, every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. Well, what that says is, look, every time I think about a good moment I've had in my life, a perfect moment I've had in my life, every time I think about something that is truly beneficial to me, you know what I need to be thinking about? That's who it came from. So why should I worship him? Because not only is he great and he has created everything, not only is he so powerful that I should just be in awe of him, but everything good has come from him. He's been a great blessing in my life. What we're going to find about God is that there's no one greater than God in my life. I'm not going to get a spouse that is so good that I'm going to be like, God, you just got nothing on this girl. Becca, you're great, baby, but you... It's no offense to her. But you're never going to have a good friend who's a better friend than God. Your parents aren't going to be better parents than God is. No one is ever going to compare to him. In Psalm 8, verses 3 and 4, it says, when I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man, that you care for him? Hear what he's saying is, look, God, you are so great. And I look at everything that you've created, everything you've spoken to existence, and I realize, look, I'm just a little speck of nothing in the midst of it. And yet you care for me. And the ways he cares for us physically, he gives us seasons. He gives us the rain. He gives us animals for food. Yes, Shannon, he gives us animals for food. So, he gives us all these things. He does things that we don't even see that we need to be appreciating. He has worms in the ground that aerate the ground for the trees. The trees produce oxygen. Well, we don't really see that, do we? But it's happening. The planet Jupiter is so big that anything that would hit Earth gets pulled into its gravitational pull, and we're kept safe because of it. There's things that he does that we don't see that are all throughout creation, the ways he protects us and cares for us physically. But he doesn't just care for us physically, does he? When we look at this picture, immediately our minds go to what we talked about earlier in the Lord's Supper, that we have great blessings now spiritually. Why? Because he went as far as he could possibly go to show us that he cares for us, that he cares about our soul, that he cares about where we spend eternity, not just what happens to us here in this world. Ephesians says it like this, you know, that this wasn't just some reaction to, well, they sinned and now I got to do something about it. God had planned it beforehand. He says, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us in Christ with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places, even as he chose us in him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and blameless before him. In love, he predestined us for adoption as sons through Jesus Christ, according to the purpose of his will, to the praise of his glorious grace, with which he has blessed us in the beloved. In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of our sins, forgiveness of our trespasses, according to the riches of his grace. Hear what he says there? Look, we now have redemption. We now have forgiveness. We now have every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. And that's what Amos was alluding to. Every spiritual blessing. And when did he plan to do it? Before he created us. He planned to care for us. He planned to love us long before we were here. So why should we worship God? Isn't it obvious? It's a privilege, isn't it? Think about this. God had a choice on who he wanted to be. If God wanted to be an evil God, guess what? He could have been an evil God. He could have created us simply to have someone to torture. And there was nothing we could have done about it. But God has chosen to be the kind of God who makes us want to love him. He's a God who's powerful, makes us stand in awe of him. He makes us want to be like him, to adore him in every way. That's the God that we serve, and that's why it's a privilege to serve him. And if we don't think about him like that, you know what? Then we're not going to put a high value on worship. It's not going to be a priority to us. We may be here, but we're not really going to care because we're not valuing him the way that we should. So there's two different kinds of worship. The first one we typically think of is congregational. When we come together, we worship collectively, we sing to one another. The other is our individual service. When we're living our lives as a living sacrifice each day, that is a form of worship. So, what is Satan trying to do here? What are his tactics to try and get us away from that worship that's pleasing to God? He wants us to have someone or something that's either equal to or greater than God in our lives, doesn't he? He wants us to be serving two masters. He wants us to be divided in who we're serving. Because then, you know what? If I'm doing that, I'm never going to be giving God my all. My worship is never going to be in spirit. Because my mind is always going to be drifting back and to between things. I'm always going to be on that fence. And the solution to that, Jesus said, was seek the kingdom first. You know, put these things aside. You seek the kingdom first. I can't let someone, a spouse, who is opposed to what God is wanting me to do, to cause me to drift away. If my wife wants me to cheat on my taxes, guess what? Sorry, baby. It's not happening. I have to love God first. If a spouse wants you to take an immoral route that you know is wrong, guess what? You choose God. You don't choose the spouse. You seek the kingdom first. If I'm willing to do that, then I can give God the spirit worship that he's looking for. He wants us to focus on ourselves instead of focusing on God. See, Satan wants us to be focused on the things that I enjoy, the things that I want. Why do so many people fall into false religions and stop worshiping according to truth? Because it quits being about what God wants in his worship. It starts being about, well, I enjoy this. I really like the music they've got over there. And they got this really good youth group. You know, they do lots of camping trips and things. And their church basketball team is just phenomenal. And the kids really enjoy it. And, you know, that's what's important to me. See, when I'm focused on myself instead of God, it's easy for me to drift away into that. And when I focus on myself instead of others, when I'm so focused on my worship, when worship becomes about me and about what you can provide me, I've missed the point. I've completely missed the point. Paul in Colossians 3, he says, "And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body, and be thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in all wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God." You see what he says there? It's not about what I can get from you. Certainly, I'm going to get something from you if you're giving it your all. But it's about what I put into it. You hear what he's saying there? Focus on singing to one another, teaching one another, admonishing one another. The focus isn't on me while I'm worshiping. The focus is on you. I'm focused on what I can do for you. So when I'm singing out enthusiastically. I'm meaning what I say. And I'm also living the life that says I mean the things that I'm saying. And he says that we should be focused on expressing our thankfulness to God. You see, there's two different aspects there. That I'm focused on others and I'm focused on God. I'm not focused on me daring worship. Because worship is not about me. And Hebrews 10, 24 and 25 says, "Let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you say the day drawing near." So if I love others, then I'm considering them, aren't I? I'm thinking about ways that I can stir you up to love and good works. And this doesn't just apply to our worship service, does it? This is everyday life. I think about ways that I can stir other people up to love and good works. But the flip side of that is, look, if I'm neglecting worshiping, that's really just a symptom of the real problem. The real problem is I'm not loving you enough to consider you. I'm not thinking about what you need. I'm only thinking about myself. So when we're not at services, it doesn't just affect us, but we're neglecting to give someone else what we should be giving them if we truly love them and care for them. So Satan likes to cause stressful situations in our lives. Why does he do that? It's pretty obvious, isn't it? Because what he wants to do is he wants you to get so focused on the thing that's going on in your life that you're not focused on God. That you won't be able to give your whole mind to your worship, to your service to God, because you're so focused on this other thing, this external thing that is going on. In Philippians 4, and starting in verse 4, it says, "Rejoice in the Lord always, and again I will say rejoice. Let your reasonableness be known to everyone. The Lord is at hand. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." He says, look, don't be anxious about anything. You know what the word anxious means? It means to have a divided mind. It means that, look, I can't really focus on this over here because I'm constantly being drawn back to this in my mind. And he says, look, don't let that happen. What's God's solution? Look, trust me, right? Leave it with me in prayer. And look, I'll give you the peace so that your mind is not divided, so that you can give me your whole mind and your whole heart. So the last thing that I want to talk about this morning as far as the tactics of Satan, and I'm sure we could go on and on with much smarter people than myself coming up with the list, but this one stands out to me. Satan wants the wrong kind of people in your life. And I'm going to explain what I mean by that. Certainly we have to be around sinners, don't we? How are you going to teach someone the gospel if you don't go and talk to them and share with them? But I think what you'll see is that's not exactly what we're talking about here. I'm going to give you a little bit of background. If you want to flip to this, you can. I'll give you a few moments to do so. In 2 Samuel chapter 6. Prior to this point, the Israelites, they haven't always been the most faithful people. And so what has happened is the Ark of the Covenant has ended up in the land of the Philistines. But David, he decides that, well, it's time to go get it back. It should be back with the people of God where it belongs. And so David has a brand new cart built, and you know, they get ready and they get this whole procession going, and they're walking the ark back, they're pulling in on the cart, and it starts to fall. And a man named Uzzah reaches up with his hand to stop it from falling over, like I think most of us probably would, just reacting to it without thinking. And the man drops dead. And if this was a lesson on following God according to truth, that's probably what our focus would be this morning. But we're going to focus on what takes place later. What happens is they end up leaving the ark with a man named Obed-Edom, who lived in the land of the Philistines. And so David leaves it with him, and what happens is, because the Ark of the Covenant is there with Obed-Edom, and he's just caring for it in the time before they come back to get it, his household is blessed. And so David hears about that. He hears about how, you know, Obed-Edom is now being blessed, and so, you know, before he was scared when Uzzah had died, he feared the Lord. He didn't want to bring the Ark around him, but now he's encouraged to do it again. When we learn from the Chronicle account that, well, he then does it the way that God had commanded, because only the only way it was supposed to be transported was having the Levites carry it. And so this time he does it God's way. So we're going to pick up our reading in 2 Samuel 6, starting in verse 12. "And it was told King David, 'The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God. So David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. And when those who bore the ark of the Lord had gone 6 steps, he sacrificed an ox and a fattened animal. And David danced before the Lord with all his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the horn. And the ark of the Lord came into the city of David. As the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. And they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And when David had finished offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts and distributed among all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both men and women, a cake of bread, a portion of meat, and a cake of raisins to each one. Then all the people departed, each to his house. And David returned to bless his household. But Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel honored himself today, and covering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." Now, at first glance, you might read this, and I don't really like the English Standard translations here, but you might read that and think, well, Michael's the righteous one here. You know, she's basically calling David out. Look, he's dancing around all vulgar. He's exposing his nakedness. But is that really what took place? We're going to talk about that. We need to ask two questions. The first one is, did David honor himself like she says? Or are we to take what she said very sarcastically? That's an important point. And did David dress or dance in a way that was sinful? Was he doing anything that was vulgar? So in 1 Chronicles 15:27 says, David was clothed with a robe of fine linen, as also were all the Levites who were carrying the ark, and the singers, and Kenanah, the leader of the music of the singers, and David wore a linen ephod. So the point is, David was dressed just like everybody else there. He's dressed just like the Levites, just like those who are singing. So, in Exodus, we're not going to read the passages, but Exodus 28 talks about how the sons of Aaron, when they were serving in the holy place, there was very strict laws about nakedness. In fact, what it says is, it talks about their clothing, but it says, look, if they expose nakedness, guess what? They're going to die. They're going to be guilty. And they're going to die because of it. See, God didn't tolerate it. You couldn't go into the holy place exposing your nakedness. That's important that we understand that. Now, I want you to think about this. What made the holy place holy? It was the holy things within it, right? It was the Ark of the Covenant being kept there. It was the other holy things. Now, was the Ark of the Covenant any less holy as they're walking down the road with it? Absolutely not, right? Why did Uzzah drop dead? Because he touched the holy thing and he didn't have a right to. See, the tent didn't make it holy. The ark is what made the tent holy. Now think about this logically. The same God who just struck down Uzzah because he treated the ark commonly and touched it when it tried to fall over, is he then going to tolerate not only David, but all the people who are singing, and even the Levites who are carrying the ark, are they exposing nakedness in the way they're dressed? Wouldn't he have struck all of them and called them guilty, and they would have all died on the spot? Isn't that the logical conclusion that we should understand from that? This is a picture of, as best I could find, of, I'm sure you can't read the text, it's pretty small. But this right here, this thing that goes over the shoulders, all the way down to the hip, that was an ephod. It was a sleeveless garment that went over the shoulders. David was wearing one of those. The sleeves you see here, and this part down here at the bottom, that's all a part of the robe that he was wearing. Now, I don't know about you. If raise your hand if you think that this man's exposing nakedness. Anybody? Because if he is, I'm going to have a talk with some of the ladies in here because he's more clothed than most women that we see today. Okay? Another picture that's pretty accurate here is this would have been what it looked like, this procession. And that would have been like the robes that they would have been wearing. Did those men, even without the ephod, did they look like they're exposing any nakedness to you? Do you see anything sinful about the clothes that they're wearing? Should be pretty obvious to us that there's not. So there wasn't anything vulgar, anything sinful about the way David was dressed. He wasn't exposing any kind of nakedness. Well, that leads us with the logical conclusion then. What was her problem? Why is she so negative about the way that he's dressed? Maybe she just didn't like the Levites. You know, the word vulgar is not really there. It's vain or empty. Maybe she felt that the fact that he had to get the Levites to carry it, that was just stupid. She didn't like it. Maybe that's what it was. We don't really know. It never says what her mindset was in this. But I think we see from David how he took it. We see it in his response to her. In 2 Samuel 6, starting in verse 21, "And David said to Michal, 'It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord. And I will celebrate before the Lord. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes. But by the female servants of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor.'" So is David saying, well, yeah, you're right. I was being sinful. I was dancing naked. I was being vulgar. I'm just, you know what? And if that made you upset, guess what? You're really going to hate it because I'm going to be even worse. Is that what he's saying? Is that the way we're to take it? Is that in any way in line with who David is? Absolutely not. One of the things that I think makes it obvious is when we look at a really literal translation here. He says, "I will be even more despised by you than this, as I will continually humble myself before the female servants you mentioned, and they will honor me." See, the point wasn't that he was dressed vulgar. The point was, he wasn't dressed like a king. He was presenting himself just like every other servant that was out there. He wasn't dressing the part. See, David understood that, look, maybe before he had dressed like a king, but he had been humbled by what happened with Uzzah, hadn't he? So what he does is he sees this as an opportunity to be a servant, to show himself as a servant. But she didn't like that. She didn't really care for a king who was going to dress like those who were meant to be under him. She had a pride problem, much like Saul did. See, David understood that she was being sarcastic. He understood that he hadn't done anything to honor himself. If anything, what he had done is he had humbled himself. He had humbled himself to the point where he looked just like everybody else. He didn't look like the king. He looked like a servant. And the fact is, we see from this text, she wasn't excited about what was taking place. She wasn't at all excited about the fact that the ark was coming back to be with the people of God. And so she thought he looked foolish as he was dancing around, as he's celebrating the ark coming back. So did David do anything wrong by dancing? That's an important question, isn't it? Ecclesiastes says this, when it's talking about how there's a time for everything, he says there's a time to weep, there's a time to laugh, there's a time to mourn, there's a time to dance. So David is dancing, and he's laughing, he's celebrating, he's extremely happy. Is he doing something sinful? Absolutely not. This word dance in Psalm 114, it's the same word, it's translated skip. It says, "The mountains skip like rams, the hills like lambs." You want to know what kind of dancing he was doing? Well, it wasn't the booty dancing you see on hip-hop videos. You want to know what kind of dancing he was doing? Tell a small child that they're going to Disney World. Watch the dancing they do as they skip through the house celebrating. That's the kind of dancing David was doing because he was that excited about what was happening, about the ark coming back to be with the people of God where it belonged. The problem is, when serving God makes us happy like that, makes us that excited, Satan wants to send a Michal to discourage that. There's different kinds of Michals that can appear in our lives. Sometimes they're antagonistic, like this one. I'm sure many of us know people like that are just antagonistic by nature. Sometimes it's more subtle, though. Sometimes it's the friend who just wants you to go hunting on Sunday morning. You know. Maybe it's the friend who talks you into going fishing Sunday morning because, look, the tide's right. Seems real innocent, doesn't it? And they're the same person that you've explained to them how important God is to you. And they know where you stand, and yet they're still trying to put that wedge between you and God, you and your zeal to God. And so, when we run into a Michael in our lives, we need to be like David. First thing he does is, he says what he's going to do, and he really doesn't care what she thinks. He says, look, I'm going to celebrate before the Lord. I'm going to humble myself. And I don't really care if you like it or not. I don't really care if it's socially acceptable. That's not what matters to me. I'm not seeking the approval of men or of even a wife. I'm seeking the approval of God. And I think we see this principle. That if your eye calls you to sin, you cut it out and you cast it from you. I think we see that in the text. I'll explain how I get that conclusion. But I think we see that with David. And as you know about David and you know how much he loved God, it's a logical conclusion that he would do this without ever having Jesus tell him to do it. He would have done this because that's the kind of person that he was. In 2 Samuel 6, right after they have this big confrontation, and David basically says, look, I don't really care what you think. I'm going to celebrate before the Lord. I'm going to humble myself before Him. It says, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. Now, maybe we could just conclude, well, she's barren. And that's all. You know, God just said, you know, well, you're just not going to be able to have kids. You know, why didn't she have children? It doesn't say she was barren, does it? I just want to show you a few verses talking about different women who were barren. Hannah, the Lord had closed up her womb. Okay? Elizabeth, she was barren. And Sarah, the Lord had prevented her from bearing children. Okay? Isaac and Rebecca. Rebecca was barren. Rachel was barren. You see that over and over again? That whenever a woman couldn't have children because the Lord had closed up her womb, she was barren. The Bible tells us that, doesn't it? So why doesn't the writer of Kings tell us that? What does he want us to know about this? About what followed this confrontation? I think what he wants us to understand is that there was no intimate relationship between them after that. That she had established that she was opposed to his zeal for God. Now, if you know the kind of person that David was, then you understand that David's not going to want to be with that person who's going to stand in the way of his zeal for God. If you love God and God is number one in your life, and you value Him, like we talked about earlier, you value worshiping Him, you're excited about worshiping Him, I'm not going to want to marry somebody who's not just like that. I'm not going to want to be close to someone and have an intimate relationship with someone, whether it be a friend, whether it be a spouse, whether it be a parent. I'm not going to want to be close to them and have them having that kind of influence on me. I'm going to want to cut that person out of my life because I realize how important God has to be. And I don't need the people closest to me being the biggest discouragers of good in my life. Now, that's all I had this morning. We're going to recap a little bit. You can go pull your songbooks out. So what we said is that a true worshiper, nobody has to force them to worship. They see worship as something that they want to do. We look at God, we look at who He is, and we just crave the idea of showing Him how much we appreciate Him because He deserves it. We recognize that. It's not a task for us to get up and come here. We want to be here. And we don't just worship on Sunday and on Wednesday. Every day of our lives, we are living as a sacrifice to Him. We're giving Him our all. It's who we are. So we're focused on our worship on others. We're not just here because I need to get something from you. I'm here to put something into it. I'm here for you to be encouraged by me. I'm here to teach you and admonish you with singing. And I'm not so focused on my problems that I forget about the one who can solve those problems. I'm focused on Him. Therefore, I leave things with Him in prayer and I'm at peace. And I can worship Him with my mind cleared of those things. And the last thing, of course, is we cut things out of our lives if we're true worshipers. Anything or anyone that's going to stand in the way of me worshiping God the way that is acceptable, that's going to discourage that in my life, I need to get rid of them. Because they're not worth having.